Welcome, fans, to another edition of Old Goat Radio here on Sunday afternoon at the Joe Hutt Memorial Fieldhouse. We have a special guest in the studio with us today. It's Ray Shelton, former radio and TV personality for WHAS here in Louisville, Kentucky, along with my colleague David Wright. We're in the studio. Our producer is John Wright. Kevin Cole is out. I believe Cincinnati is scouting his son Max for baseball, and so Kevin definitely wants to be a part of that and make sure that the signing bonus is correct. So, Kevin, we miss you. But first off, I'd really like to say, Ray, thanks for coming on to Old Goats Radio.
Thank you for asking me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And actually, as my producer, John, will correct me, it's Old Goat Radio. I want to make sure I get that right. And Ray, I know you've been around Louisville for a long time, and you are a graduate of Manual High School. And what year did you graduate?
45 and a half.
1945 and a half. So you're
back a ways, doesn't
it? It does go back a ways, and we've heard, particularly come Hall of Fame time at Manual, we hear about the stories from the Brook and Oak alumni, and that makes you one of those. The three of us all graduated from Second and Lee, but you can take us back to Brook and Oak. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I remember the days because I was trying hard to be intelligent, first of all, and secondly, had the idea that I wanted to do some radio or television, so rode the streetcar.
Interesting.
Back a ways when they were running in Louisville. I have no idea when they were taken off, and we got what they call buses or coaches.
Mm-hmm.
But got off at, that would have been 4th and Oak, I guess.
Probably, yep.
The old building is still there, and I sure remember it well. I had some good teachers, and I had some that probably scared me a little bit.
And they're condominiums in that building now, but they are keeping the property up. I believe that's what
it is. I didn't know that.
That's what it is. There was a middle school there for a number of years, and then they turned it over so residences. I don't know if anybody who went to Manual in those days moved back down there to live, but
yeah.
That's an interesting use of the school building. So,
I had some good teachers. I had one who taught metalworking.
Mm-hmm.
We made a scoop or something of the kind out of metal, and one that taught woodworking, made an end table. I was always proud of that. And then I had one who scared me. His name was G.C. Newton.
Okay.
He taught math, and he had one of those phrases, if you couldn't answer the question, it was a big zero for you, Mr.
Oh.
Shelton.
That would be an intimidating phrase to come from a teacher anyway.
I often doubted whether or not I was learning as much or the other students if they were scared to death of him. His GC stood for Grover Cleveland, one of our presidents.
Wow.
And he was a character.
Well, it sounds like it. Well, tell us a little bit more about your experiences at Manual, and I know we want to get into your experiences after Manual, because you've already said that you had an idea what you wanted to be, and it turned out that's what you became. But tell us a little bit more about Manual.
Well, I was interested in basically, I guess, getting through school like most. Excuse me. A bit hoarse today. But I had limited time. I was working on or helping with the Manual Mirror. That's
mm-hmm.
the correct name, as I remember, of the paper. And the professor who taught English and speech was Morton Walker. And he goes back, of course, to the 30s and 40s there. And he took an interest in my announcing ability, or a lack thereof at that point. And I hung around up there a good bit. They had a big old recording machine, which would play the old 78s, which we don't fool with much anymore.
Not much.
Not in this time. But it would play the old 78s, and he would invite us up. We could listen to that. And then he would work on speech, because, as you know, on radio or television, you can't get on there and make too many grammatical errors.
Correct.
So he was good at that sort of thing. But he was probably the outstanding one among the staff at Manual that I enjoyed working with and having tout a little bit. Yeah, go ahead and try for it. And then he said, we're getting a program once a week. Manual High will be on. and we will allow you to be the announcer on the show. And boy, what a chore that was, and also, and I suppose, a challenge. Because he said, we're going to have guests on. You'll have to line them up and find out what you're going to ask them, but you will be in charge. It was a 15-minute show. Not hard to do. And it was rotated among the high schools in the area. Mm-hmm. So I enjoyed that. But I guess I began to zero in on English, grammar, literature I did not like, but English, grammar, and his speech class, because I knew I wanted to be good if I was going to be on television or radio, if I ever made it. Who knew about that at that stage in life?
Well, that was early in the career of radio and television, particularly in this area,
yep,
as well. So
we did. We had four or five radio stations.
Mm-hmm.
Wave was on top of the Brown Hotel. Most people did not know that. HAS had come on in 1922.
Right.
And they catered toward eastern Kentucky and people up in the mountains. And basically we had a couple of other smaller stations, but television had not come into Louisville because the first station was Wave,
mm-hmm,
in 1948.
That's right. I remember it used to be their slogan when I did watch them on TV. First in Kentucky was
That's
their
right.
slogan.
They were.
And by the way, I might say that the credit that you're giving to your teachers has really taken hold, because I still see how you enunciate properly, and your voice is clear and recognizable from those years that you spent on radio and TV. So when we think of today's classes and schools, because students today are being almost pointed in a direction, even in middle school, to where they want to make their career, you had decided, and the teachers at Manual helped you, but you knew what you wanted to be, and you went on to have a pretty nice career, from what I can tell.
Well, I think it worked out that way. Made a pretty good living for me.
It and definitely you're a recognizable figure around Louisville. And I know coming from Manual, it must have been nice to be able to work in your home city.
That's true, because of our announcers in the old days, among them Bud Abbott, who is not part of the comedy team, another Bud Abbott, Jim Walton, who came up from the University of Florida,
mm-hmm,
and four or five others that we could name. They all came from out of town.
Really?
But in this case, hometown boy made good.
Well, and you certainly did, and things were much different back in the early days when you got into radio. But let me ask you this. Did you go anywhere from Manual, like to U of L or to any college, to learn broadcasting? Or
no, I never took another class.
Really?
Morton Walker's was it. He must have been a good professor. Better than I've given him credit for today, perhaps, because he did teach that you have to have good speech. And he taught, open your mouth when you talk. Don't do the mumbling. That sort of thing.
Very good advice that I probably need to work on.
No, enunciation is good. And you know, once you learn it, it stays with you.
Yes.
I have found. Now, I did get some work along the way at U of L, part-time. And so I was working for a little daytimer, WLOU. And that's where I was. Mm-hmm. When I made the move to TV.
Okay.
But they were willing to take a novice. I had a way of getting on stations because I would watch them put the tower up. And I thought, that's going to be a broadcast station. Do you remember where they were at the time?
I don't know.
Eastern Parkway.
That's right. Eastern Parkway.
Okay.
Behind the...
that's right. I do remember now.
Behind the Parkmore.
Behind Parkmore.
So I saw him putting up a radio tower, and I thought, hey, there's a chance to get a job. And it worked out. They hired me. Do a little disc jockey work and a little bit of news. And you learn as you go at that stage.
Sure.
Learn to do things and what not to do. We had a program director who seemed to be moving around from station to station. He didn't get much enjoyment out of listening to us, so he sort of got out of the way, and we did what we wanted to do. So that's where I was when I moved into television.
Okay.
An announcer there by the name of Cliff Mercer, who's now gone on to Chicago and now retired, said, "Hey, Ray, I hear they're looking for an announcer, that Channel 11 is going on the air. Bingham's are putting on television." Mm-hmm. And he said, "I went down and talked to Paul Clark, and he told me he'd call me, but he hasn't called. Why don't you go down and try? I'll bet you can't get on either." That was a pretty good challenge.
I'll bet.
So I went down and talked to Paul, a great guy, the chief announcer. And he said, "Come on in and audition next Tuesday." And I was there, a little early, in fact. And he said, "We've auditioned 30 or 32 people, local people around town, some of them professionals, and some are non-professionals, who want this job. You got a good face, Ray. We think we'd like you. But I don't know. I've got to call in two other people. I've got to call in the program director, and I've got to call in the fellow we hired from New York who's putting our TV station together." And I said, "Okay." So I did the first audition for Paul Clark, mm-hmm. and then he's on the phone, and I'm watching, and I thought, well, I hope I didn't fail, because he's bringing in another man. He listened and said, "I got to bring in number three."
Wow.
He's the big boss, and he will tell you. So I did the audition three times, and I'm getting pretty sweaty at that point, because I figure I don't know how I'm doing. Excuse me. And the big boss said, "You know, we kind of like the way you sound, Ray, but my wife is waiting on a parking meter down on Broadway, and I can't keep her waiting, so I can't talk to you now. I'll call you Monday." And talk about a long weekend.
I'll bet it was.
Yeah, because he did not want to give me an answer. I think he knew what he wanted to do one way or the other. So they said, "Can you start in 2 weeks?" I said, "Sure can." Because in the back of my mind, I knew that WLOU was going to black programming, mm-hmm. and I couldn't have done that.
Probably not. I could definitely see that change in programming would mean your exit from that station.
So it was an interesting transition, and it came just in time. I've been lucky most of my life, my wife says very lucky, in getting jobs, in winning auditions, and that sort of thing. So I got to say, at this stage in life, I'm happy that I've done so well.
Well, and you certainly have, and you were a recognizable figure on WHAS for a number of years.
25,
and that's a long time. And when I think of how the business is today, what I read in the paper, and I'm certainly not an insider, but what I read in the paper of how conglomerates have taken over radio and TV stations, and a lot of the decisions are made out of town, it's interesting the story you just gave, how you went through the interview process all locally, and then the decision came after a weekend of sleeping on it.
Those were good times, because basically it was a different approach to both radio and TV. I did principally TV for 11.
Yes.
Did some radio, because they were both owned, of course, by the Binghams. But they were still strong at that point in 1950 when they went into TV. They were still strong in their radio station.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a powerhouse, being 50,000 watt clear channel, mm-hmm. and they did not really know what TV was going to do, and it didn't do much for the first couple of years. We had a hard time getting sponsors in those days, because sponsors didn't want to pay the rates.
Sure.
It was a bit more than the radio rate, and they knew radio was pretty productive, got them business. So they didn't know whether they wanted to make the change or not. So they said, "Ray, you're hired." They hired me on a Monday morning, said, "Be here in 2 weeks. We're going to go on the air March 27th, 1950.
Okay.
And you did pretty well reading to the music stand when you auditioned. We're going to have live cameras for you to read to on March 27th. And I said, okay, you know, I haven't done any TV. They said, nobody here has. We hired a fellow from Wave, and he had about two or three weeks down there.
Wow.
So we've hired him away to run our operation, and you'll be working with him. It was an interesting transition because everybody was learning.
Well, yeah, so you were a real trailblazer in the Louisville area. Many of our listeners can't imagine what life would be like without television and have TVs probably in three or four rooms of their house. But I think that's probably one of the things that your sponsors were balking at. Who's out there buying televisions and watching?
That's true, because in the early days, do you remember how small the screen was?
Oh, yes.
A little 7-inch or 9-inch.
With a big box around it.
I know. With a big box that had all the tubes.
Yes.
And people would, including later on, Saturday night, would watch Test Pattern,
mm-hmm.
as John alluded to earlier in our conversation. They wouldn't watch anything that moved, and
right.
Test Pattern didn't even move. But then they put on the color bars. Do you remember those?
I remember when they first came out. My house was one of the last in the neighborhood to get color television.
Really?
But I was fortunate in another way because my father worked for the old Stewart Dry Goods, the department store,
yeah.
and he delivered furniture. So while we only had black and white TV, we had two because in those days when somebody bought a new television, they would, and they bought it from Stewart's, then when my father delivered that one, they would say, well, why don't you take this old one out? And so the employees there had a stockpile of old appliances, televisions, stoves, refrigerators, and when something broke at home, they took it with them.
Your comment there was a bit of history because Stewart's was the place to buy.
Oh, yeah.
Everything. Fourth and what we used to call Walnut, right?
Right on the corner. And I actually had a job over the Christmas holidays where I worked down there, and that was always a fun time to try to squeeze onto one of the packed elevators because back in those days, again, history, folks went downtown to shop for Christmas.
They were busy. Well, back to the early days, if you want to go that far
sure.
back. We're in 1950, and you know what war broke out in 1950?
That would have been Korea.
That is correct. And here's a young kid has done no news, and the news department didn't want to come up to TV on the seventh floor.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to do it because they had to put a shirt and a tie on, and they had to wear Max Factor makeup.
Wow.
Right out of the can, and number five preferably, because in the early days with black and white,
mm-hmm.
you had to put makeup on so you didn't look pale.
Okay.
And so I was agreeable to putting makeup on. There was no choice. And I had to read the news headlines for the Korean War. And so I learned a lot along the way. And I don't know how many were correct pronunciations and how many were incorrect. But they were not easy. So I said to the program director somewhere along the way, hey, how much of this am I going to be doing? And he said, oh, we're turning it all over to you. Anything on TV, you will do. And
wow.
I thought, well, that's pretty good. So as a result, along the way in the early years, I learned to fry on a deep fryer called a Fry-Rite.
Okay.
And I learned that when you put shrimp in a Fry-Rite, you bring it out when it's real pale, not at all brown, because for the black and white color television tube, it would look black or burned if you fried it to the eye. It did not match that. I learned to ride a motorcycle and four or five other things that I'd never done before because I said, Ray, it's all yours. You do them all as they come along. And I think I had as many as 15 live commercials, live on camera. A week.
Wow.
So I earned, because I started at $68 a week. Now, that's for the biggest station in town. Not that they didn't have the money at WHAS radio, of course.
But that was probably the going rate, or?
Yeah, it was a little low. We found out that Jim Walton was making $15,000 a year.
Oh.
He was the senior announcer, and he was liked by the company. So he was paid big, big money. And somebody said in our lounge one day to me, you know, if we could ever earn what Jim Walton is earning, we'd be set, wouldn't we? I said, yeah, let's work a little harder.
And that was probably the mindset from a lot of people back in the early days of television, that you could work a little bit harder because you really maybe didn't even know where you were going.
You had that spirit in those days.
Mm-hmm.
I think we had more get up and go to achieve than maybe some of the folks here in 2009. I don't know that to be true. It's not true generally, mm-hmm. but it was true then. We had people who wanted to sound good and look good and be part of the industry. See, we had nothing at all from network.
Right.
Because there was no network. There was a network in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And a network on the West Coast, but they could not get the picture to us.
Okay.
We had what we call coaxial cable that brought it later on, but they could not get it from there to here because we were too far inland.
I see.
Either one. They had a network, I would suppose, of 8 or 10 stations out of New York, of Philly, Boston, mm-hmm. and the like. But we were too small to fool with in Louisville. So we had to buy the programs. As an example, Ed Sullivan, remember that show?
Yes.
Did his show from the theater on Sunday night.
Right.
And they made what they called a kinescope. John, you mentioned that earlier, the kinescope. It was a very poor black and white. But they put it on a Greyhound bus for us, and we got it on Wednesday and played it Wednesday night on Channel 11.
Okay. Well, now, I knew that a lot of programs were delayed, but I didn't connect the Sunday to Wednesday for the Ed Sullivan show.
No. A lot of others, too, were delayed. And, of course, the movies you bought were some good and some bad.
Right.
Because your movie peddler who would come to town and show you his list of movies would give you some good ones and a bunch of dogs. And you showed the dogs once or twice and stopped showing them, but the good movies you would show over and over.
Sure.
Or maybe you'd play them on the early show and the late show.
Right.
But there was not much choice. And the most amazing thing of all, I'm talking a lot, but I'll go on till you stop me.
That's fine.
The Bingham said, you know, don't put anything on our television station on Saturday night, because that's when Edie and Barry Jr. and I all go to movies. The Bingham family went to a movie, and they were on 4th Street,
mm-hmm.
of course, alive. And so we didn't turn the television set on, the transmitter on, Saturday night at all.
Really?
The screen was dark.
Now, I didn't know that either. That's a bit of history that I didn't know.
Well, Wave was programming, so they had it all to themselves. I imagine 5,000 to 10,000 people who might have had sets
mm-hmm.
at the time. So after a year or so, we decided we better program, and I got to give up my Saturday night off. But those were interesting years, and anything you said on the air went out.
Oh, yeah.
If you made a face, the audience saw it. If you said a wrong word or a bad word, that went out.
No 7-second delay
no.
like they talk about
no.
today and those kind of things.
The radio show did that down on radio, the Milton Metz show.
Yes.
Was on a 7-second delay. So that if he heard a word that shouldn't go out, he had an engineer across the glass, and he would give him the cut signal.
Sure.
And it would erase, effectively, and he would explain, we've terminated this conversation. But basically, up until 1964, when we got that videotape machine,
mm-hmm.
everything you said went out.
Our guest in the studio today is Ray Shelton, former WHAS television personality, who also did some radio. And Ray's been telling us about the early years of TV in Louisville, Kentucky. And so, Ray, tell us a little bit more about some of the shows that you hosted early on before the networks got involved.
Well, we did a live show, Buzz, called Walton Calling.
Mm-hmm.
It was a carryover from Jim Walton's radio show.
Okay.
But it would attract a live audience, and we would seat maybe 30 or 40 people and give away prizes and do stunts and do that sort of thing. And I was the announcer for Jim Walton, again, being inexperienced at what you see now on network television of what the announcer does. But it was a good show. It was a half-hour show. And then I read the news live at 10 o'clock. We got off early. We would sign on about 5 with moving tape and that test pattern that we've talked about. And we did early news headlines. And then the news department came up to do news at 6.
Okay.
A fellow named Pete French that not many people would remember, but he was one of the pioneers. And then we had to fill in the hours between then and the late show. But we got all of those by kinescope. So if that's the best you've ever seen, you accepted it, you
sure.
see. You'd never seen videotape. And so we had basically, Oh, I Love Lucy was big, and some of those shows.
Mm-hmm.
And you would do announcements in between and that sort of thing. But basically, the early years were pretty primitive. We did a news, I did, and then I sat there and talked about the weather board. Couldn't get up. That would be rather awkward to walk over there. Talked about the weather board and then gave the sports headlines and said, we leave the air at 10:15 at night. Can you believe that? Because, see, there was nothing to offer.
Right. And things are so different now, but I do remember seeing the test pattern come on, and I also remember that the station would sign off and play the national anthem. And if I'm not mistaken, I remember seeing, like, the flag in the background waving, and then when the national anthem was over, that was the end of programming, and that's when the test pattern popped
up. See, that simply does not happen now.
No.
They do not sign off. They pick up from satellite some programming
mm-hmm.
and keep the station on the air, not only radio, but television.
Right.
So the change has been very dramatic.
And that, it kind of follows a line today that a lot of industries have followed, but you mentioned the satellite and the programming, and so I would think in some ways there are fewer local personalities on stations today than there were back in the early days when you didn't broadcast 24 hours.
There are, because the station managers have learned to save money.
Mm-hmm.
And they now hire a trained voice, an announcer or something close to that, for drop-ins.
Yes.
A drop-in is put in between segments or between records. And it sounds like you've got a disc jockey there. But he came in for 2 hours, made the drop-ins for all day long, in some cases,
mm-hmm.
and has left and was paid for 2 hours. It's really tightened up.
You mentioned radio and listening to various stations that I listen to, and today you can actually find the same personality on two stations at the same time, occasionally, and it goes back to what you just said. They've done their part, they've done their announcing, and they're probably not even at the station, and yet if you flip fast enough, you may hear them talking about two different subjects at the same time.
And sometimes a fellow who is talented with creative voices and that sort of thing
mm-hmm.
will feed 3 or 4 stations around the country. He'll make them and send them instantaneously by today's modern methods.
Sure.
And they will play the same thing, and so they've got an interesting, rather clever disc jockey in their town, even though he lives 150, 200 miles away.
It hasn't been that long ago. There was an article in the Courier Journal about Rick Dees, who's a big DJ out in California who owns land in Kentucky, and he was doing exactly that. He's also known all across the nation, so it's interesting how far it's become, and yet, again, as a pioneer, you were just doing everything right there, live on the air.
I was glad that I was on the air and worked for them during those years, 1950 to 1975, because you were allowed to be more creative, and the programming was such that you enjoyed what you were doing. Now, the automation has pretty well ruled it out. Before we end our interview, we ought to talk a little about Crusade for Children.
Absolutely.
It started in 1953. We had had two other shows, one for the Heart Fund mm-hmm. and one for another source that I cannot remember what we did. But we started Crusade in 1953 and, of course, began inviting well-known names. Mm-hmm. Sam Gifford, our program director, would go to New York and from a central casting there would pick the best names he could for what we could afford to pay them to come to Louisville for the day and a half of the Crusade. And that began to raise more and more money. But it was a joy to work, to see the kids, to have a chance to work with the various people that were in for just the Crusade. Mm-hmm. One of the richest fellows on the West Coast, who is now deceased, and his name is on both of the shows at 7 and 7:30, and I'm trying to come up with his name. He is the producer. He created them, he said.
Okay.
He was here. Why can't we think of his name?
Wouldn't be Merv Griffin.
Yes, that's okay. Exactly it. Merv came to town. Merv then was into singing with a big band.
Yes, I remember.
You remember that?
Yes, sir.
And he was creating and had his own talk show.
Mm-hmm.
But Merv got on stage one day in the early hours, the first hour of the Crusade. Jim Walton and I are working it. I've got cards to read. Jim is on stage. And Jim came to me and said, I can't get him to shut up. I've given him a speed up. You know the signs.
Yes.
And I've given him a cut. But he's getting good laughs. So he won't leave the stage. Ray, we've got to get him off because Mr. Sholas, our boss, has scripted this first hour. And we've got to keep everything on time. He said, I'm going to throw it to you and interrupt him for just a minute to read cards. And I'm going over and get him by the arm and lead him off as we're talking. Now, that's one of the billionaires in California, a very talented guy whom I respect. But that's what we had to do to get Merv Griffin off the stage of the Crusade. He didn't understand the kids were the important thing.
Right.
He had done his bit, and he would not shut up.
And you know, the church that I grew up in downtown Louisville, one of the young men who went there had grown up with cerebral palsy. And every year, the Crusade weekend was like the highlight of his year because he knew how much the Crusade had helped him, and he'd collect quarters and dimes and nickels or dollar bills or whatever from anybody he could find, and he'd go down there and he'd walk through the line, he'd wait in line, and it was just an exciting time to him to be able to bring a little bit of money back and give it back, but also for that little bit of time that he'd get to spend on the air when somebody
sure.
would interview him.
The kids were great, the talent was wonderful, and most of it was donated.
Mm-hmm.
We did pay the people because the union said we had to pay.
Right.
If they came to New York and were here for on stage for so many hours, they had to be paid. But most of them donated part or all of it back. That was the nice thing. I can't overlook working one morning at 3 o'clock in the morning when I was working with McLean Stevenson.
I remember him.
Is that the fellow who was on MASH?
He was the first. He was Colonel Blake on MASH.
Colonel
yes.
Blake. Okay. So McLean Stevenson came to me and said, I think maybe after a couple of drinks, Ray, did you know that I was a pole vaulter in my high school and college? I said, no, I didn't know that, sir. And we did anything to fill the time.
Sure.
Because the band had gone on a break at 3 o'clock. He said, find me a pole if you can. Now, we were at Memorial Auditorium.
Yes.
And I went down to the basement, and I got one of these 12-foot cane poles mm-hmm. that they wrap a rug in. You know what I'm saying?
I do.
And I said, okay, I'll alert the producer, Bob Pilkington, that you're going to pole vault. What do you plan to do? And he said, I'm going to get back down the aisle here, and I'm going to run to the stage, and I'm going to go over the orchestra pit here and land on stage. You will see my talents. He got back and he ran, but the pole broke. So he got up in the air, but he landed among the music stands on his behind, as Marilyn Monroe would say. So Pilkington, who was on duty, said, "Get off of him, he's flat of his ass."
Now, I must admit, I don't remember that one.
You wouldn't have seen it.
No. That must have been an exciting time for you. Especially when you think that, has my guest killed himself,
yes,
or what?
What do I say next? But at 3 o'clock in the morning, fortunately, only a few people were around. I got one other that's worth telling out of the crusade. Excuse me, I'm sorry about the voice. We basically had lots of guests. Most of them were good.
Mm-hmm.
Nearly all of them wanted to be good. They didn't all understand that the kids were the
right,
truly important thing. And so we had a fellow named Don DeFore. He was the neighbor on a couple of serial shows.
Mm-hmm.
And he disappeared in the middle of the night, but was scheduled for working with the kids at 8 o'clock Sunday morning. And so, come 8 o'clock, Mr. Scholes was there, who held the script and was a strict, strict person. And he says, "Where is Don DeFore? I've got him scheduled on, and we don't have anybody to go in." And I said, "I don't know." And he came in about 9:30. And so Scholes took him off before he went on stage. And he said, "Don, where have you been? You're about an hour and a half late. This show is scripted, and I believe you were told that, and you're being paid for being on time." And he said, "Well, Mr. Scholes, I tell you, it was Saturday night, and another buddy and I that I teamed up with went out to make a one-reeler." And Scholes says, "What's a one-reeler?" And Don DeFore said, "That's a babe, a bottle, and a bed." So we couldn't put that one on the air either.
Probably not.
We had some good ones. Most of them were good. But most of them also were unpredictable. Dave, you're enjoying that one, aren't you?
Well, and I can imagine when you had folks come in from New York or Hollywood or somewhere to Louisville, even though we think of Louisville as a pretty exciting town, I'm thinking that they see things a little bit differently when they come to town, so they probably didn't realize exactly what they had.
He was looking for something to do.
Yeah.
So let's see. We've talked through the early days when everybody made mistakes, Milton Metz included. I'll tell one on Milt. He won't mind.
By the way, I hate to interrupt, but I just yesterday was looking up trying to find some information about you and saw a picture of you standing next to Mr. Metz at a reunion of the WHAS radio.
Right?
Yes, sir.
Who had that one, I wonder?
It's on lkyradio.com.
See, I've never seen that. That's on the Internet.
Yes.
Okay, Milt and I got along fine. We did a lot of competitive auditions. He won some, and I won some.
Mm-hmm.
But we had just sold the weather show.
Okay.
Now, this is the early 50s, and we're trying to get some sponsors in, and they came in from Atlanta, Pepsi-Cola. And they were in the client's booth watching, and it's time to do the weather, and they're there at 11:15, 11:20 when he went on. And so he said, "We have a new sponsor today. And I'd like to introduce and let you know that every night we'll be talking about the beautiful, bubbly Pepsi-Cola." And the fellow off stage hands him the bottle, and it's a Coca-Cola bottle, just
oh, no,
as distinctive as it can be. Needless to say, we lost that account. Because you cannot mistake the Coke bottle.
Having worked for the Coca-Cola bottler here in Louisville for 27 years. I know all about the cola wars, and I can imagine they couldn't get away from you guys fast enough.
I'm feeding you some good lines, aren't I, Buzz?
That is one that I hadn't heard, but I know now where I work, I actually deal with both sides of that fence, and they still don't like each other.
No, never will. And, of course, the cola wars are written up once in a while, and I know about placement in the supermarkets.
Oh, yeah.
Who gets the eye-level placement on the shelf, and who you got to reach over for or reach up here, that sort of thing. So, anyway, I stayed 25 years and was happy to be invited to continue doing my one and only commercial in the early days was Great Financial Federal.
I remember.
We did that for 42 years because they asked me to come over there to the Great Financial Federal main office and work there as public relations.
Mm-hmm.
So we've now gone from the station and the activities there to a savings and loan, quite a change of pace.
I'll bet.
They didn't like some of the clothes I wore, which were checks and red coats that I had bought just for TV.
Sure.
He said, we wear gray or a black suit here. You know the banker.
Oh, yeah.
The way they dress.
Yeah.
So I had to change for that. But otherwise, that was a good stay. I stayed 24 years there.
And I remember you doing those commercials for a long, long time.
Yeah. They were a good sponsor. And the fellow who ran that, his name was Flexner, Gustav Flexner. He started it in 1918. And he built it into the largest savings and loan in the state of Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
They were jealous at Cumberland, which later became what? Commonwealth? I've forgotten the name. Yeah, the name they took.
Maybe.
But basically, Cumberland, and they were jealous because we were bringing the money in. And Flexner knew how to offer a little gift.
Mm-hmm.
If you bring in $100, new money, we'll give you a pen and pencil set. Or some other little trivial thing. We gave away calendars and we gave away thermometers one time. And this is going back to the 50s and 60s.
Sure.
But the man knew how to promote the business. So I had a good stay at Great Financial.
Now, wasn't Great Financial Federal, wasn't that Greater Louisville Savings and Loan before it became that?
Ah, you got a good memory.
Once in a while.
Yes, it was.
I thought so. See, I remember the commercials.
And do you know why they changed?
I think it had to do with just broadening, or they bought another savings and loan. I'm not sure.
Went to Lexington.
Okay.
And we didn't think Greater Louisville, First Federal Savings and Loan, would fly in Lexington.
I think that was a good thought. I think you're absolutely right
it's
there.
It's kind of like the mail manual rivalry.
Yes, it would have been.
So we changed. We hired a company out of Chicago to come down. And said, create a new name for us. Wanted to have the sign of strength and that sort of thing. And they did. And we paid them a pretty good penny to do so. But we changed from Greater Louisville First Federal to Great Financial.
Mm-hmm.
And it's since changed four times and is now U.S. Bank.
Okay.
One of the big banks in the nation.
Yes,
we
it
got
is.
Got them here in Louisville. So I stayed. I had two careers. I guess I was lucky. As my wife said, I stayed 25 years one place and 20 at another, and that's long enough.
But with that, you some of the attributes of what Dave mentioned off air about the greatest generation that Tom Brokaw wrote about, and that's that tenacity, the desire to succeed, and then the perseverance to hang in there in a changing industry that continues to change today, you forged two changing industries, really, and you forged two nice long careers.
They've served me well.
Absolutely.
I could have gone hopping, as some people unfortunately have to do now, with the slowdown in the economy we're having here in the early part of 2009. Not a fortunate situation, but in those days, I think it was a great generation, and I think things were more stable among employers. You don't get the gold watch anymore.
No.
It's thank you for your service. We've enjoyed it. I wish you could stay.
Right. And I'm thinking back, too, as the networks became involved, did you ever think anything of maybe moving on to one of the networks, maybe going to New
York?
Well,
I got a story on that. You brought it up, so I'll tell you.
Well, bring it on.
We had a fellow from Atlanta named Lee Jordan. He would have preceded your days probably. But he said to me one day in the announcer's lounge, "Ray, you ought to go to New York and audition. CBS is going to hire three men from out in the country. The three best to audition will be hired for summer." Mm-hmm. And that would be a stint April through November. And you'd get to work for CBS Radio, CBS Television. You'd be a staff member. And they pay a pretty good staff salary. I said, "I think I'll go up there and try." I was another lucky guy. I went up, and they gave you everything possible. An audition contains a good one, at least seven or eight different kinds of copy.
Mm-hmm.
So you read a couple of news headlines. Then they gave you a couple of commercials.
Sure.
They gave you some classical music to read. And I got through Rachmaninoff and Saint-Saëns and some of those pretty good. And then you're supposed to imagine you're doing a dance band remote from the Blue Room of Hotel Astor. You're upbeat and you're bright because you got a group here.
Sure.
And I did it, and he said, "Well, we've had about 140 people."
Wow.
"From around the nation audition. But we're going to do our final audition in another month, and I'll let you know if you're one of the 10 chosen for finalists." And by golly, one day on the phone, he said, "Come back to New York. We've got to hear you again."
That's great.
So I was chosen among three or four. Four, there was a backup.
Yeah.
And I was number two for CBS in New York.
Wow.
Now, I couldn't go because we had got a youngster, the young lady who had had an operation. And so we decided to decline.
Mm.
The fellas on the announcing staff said, "You're crazy. You had a chance to go to New York." And I said, "Yes." And it would have been good, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, I auditioned. So the fellow from Memphis went. When I didn't go, I was number two. I don't know who was number one, but he filled in my place. But living in New York and some of the things I've learned since then, I never fretted it. I never looked back.
Well, I'd say that was New York's loss and the country's loss because you weren't on national TV, but Louisville's gain.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that.
You certainly had a respected career, and you still are, as I sit here talking to you today, one of the most recognizable voices to me that just pops up. You've got that smooth delivery, and just the baritone just rings out when you speak.
I appreciate that, even without the hoarseness.
Even with that, and even in our primitive studio that we have here at the Joe Hutt Fieldhouse.
Well, I've enjoyed being with you. Thank you for asking me to be on. And I guess on the Internet, we'll be heard by a few. I might even go someplace and listen.
Well, there you go. Yes, we'll be heard on Old Goat Radio. Any other things that you want to bring up before we cut things off?
I think we've brought it up from my start as a young guy at 22 to Network Try, which would have been, of course, the ultimate for many people.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they would have made good money. But they had at that time 18 announcers on staff. And I thought, boy, will they ever get down to the bottom two or three. So I think I've pretty well completed it, and I appreciate your asking.
Okay. One last question I have is, do you remember what your final show was on WHAS?
No, I don't.
Okay. That settles that really quickly.
We won't be able to stretch that out at all, will we?
Well, fans, I just wanted to say thanks again, and we've had a great day today so far, and this is Buzz Frank for Old Goat Radio signing off.